The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, as we begin today, we're considering the Reformation theme of the Swiss-German side of what happened in the 16th century. We've had opportunity to reflect on the Lutheran Reformation. Now we want to turn our attention to the Reformed part of the Reformation, that is the work that comes especially through Ulrich Zwingli, John Calvin, and then ultimately into Scotland and England under the leadership of John Knox. As we begin today, let's take a few moments and just highlight some fundamental issues about this gentleman named Ulrich Zwingli. Again, his name is spelled in many different ways, and I'm not going to care really how you spell his first or last name as long as it looks close to the real thing. His date's 1484 to 1531. He was born in Switzerland. He was educated in Vienna and Basel. He entered the priesthood in 1506. So there's a parallel with Luther in approximately the year of his birth, just about a year after Luther, and like Luther, was trained to be a priest. Some of the key things that we find in differences between Zwingli and Luther is that along the way, Zwingli, in his education, was profoundly influenced by the humanist movement, and specifically Erasmus and his leadership. So as Luther, who had developed a theological perspective that was consistent in many ways with classic medieval theology, Erasmus was already being influenced in his early years by the new ad fontes mentality, back to the fountains, back to the original writings. And as a result, he began to develop a profound insight into the biblical text, and he claims that he discovered the gospel of salvation by faith, by God's grace, on his own investigations in the New Testament. I think I mentioned the other day that he actually wrote the entire New Testament with his own hand, copied it out so that he might perfect it word for word. And on top of that story, I think it's interesting to note that Beza, Calvin's later successor, memorized the entire Greek New Testament. So for some of you who are wrestling with Greek, remember that that's within the realm of possibility if you're willing to pursue it. You may need a brain like Beza's to accomplish it, but it's an important thing. Now, as a Swissman, he had a national heritage that was quite different from a German. They spoke German, but a very different dialect. They had a very different heritage. Germany had historically been under the rule of the Holy Roman Empire with all of its systems of gradated lesser kingdoms, where Switzerland had developed something of that a kind of independence that has always been associated with Switzerland. They had the distinct regions that were reflecting the notion of self-government to a certain extent. And that carries with it a very different spirit in many ways. Luther looked down his nose at the Swiss German. He thought it was I think he called it a greasy German or something like that. He has a very interesting phrase. He didn't like the sound of it. It was not precise. And so there was, when these men will ultimately meet, there was already inherent tensions, different training, the humanist background versus the medieval background, a German versus a Swissman with their different culture, with their different language, their different experience of the state, etc. He will ultimately, in 1518, be called to Zurich, which will become the seat of his leadership, and his Reformation will begin to take place in that context. And in his Reformation, he will be much more like Erasmus in that the humanists had developed something of the Neoplatonic spirit that moved in the direction of a very strict asceticism. There already was a deep asceticism, obviously, in the medieval tradition. That's at the core of the monastic movements. But the Roman Catholic tradition in the medieval era had developed a remarkable comfort level with the Renaissance art forms. They were enjoyed the beauty, the luxury, the grandeur of all of that. And in Erasmus, there was an emphasis on this idea that we must downplay the visual, the sensual, the sensory for the intellectual. That was part of what he wanted to see as the Reformation in the church. And so Erasmus, for example, was not sure that the church ought to be using musical instruments. Okay? And Zwingli will fall into that tradition. The idea of the great artwork, and remember we talked about Karlstadt versus Luther and the iconoclasm issues. That was something that had some reflection from the humanist movement. They were not necessarily iconoclasts, but they wanted to emphasize the intellectual versus the visual. Now, there was something of a prejudice here already, because one of the arguments for the iconodules, or those that worshipped, or that's too strong of a word, let's say venerated icons, was that they were the books of the illiterate. Okay, you would go to church, you could not read, you would hear some of the gospels and the biblical readings given, and then you would look at the windows and learn a lot of theology by seeing the stained glass windows, by looking at the paintings, looking at the statues, and you were to learn your theology. You didn't know how to read. What was Erasmus's solution? Stop giving them images and give them writing. Teach people to read. Give them the books in their original languages. So you can see as part of the spirit of the asceticism was not only the Renaissance spirit of returning to classical literature in certain ways that might have brought in some of that earlier Platonic type thinking, but also the whole idea of there was an abuse that put so much emphasis on the outward and not enough on the intellectual, the visual versus the internal knowledge. At any rate, Zwingli was part of that. And we're going to find another reason for this breach between Zwingli and Luther that we've already spoken about, because of a very different style of worship that will emerge from Zurich, which is going to be less musically oriented, less ritualistic, less icon-focused, much more willing to break with the past to be more distinctively biblical. Okay, and I'm not prejudicing at this moment the case whether the Bible permits icons or not. Okay, I don't want to suggest that. That's for another discussion. At any rate, as that development takes place, within this movement, there will quickly begin to be those who follow along with Zwingli, and as they do, they will be delighted in the power of his movement that will go to the Swiss leaders and say, let us have a debate with the Roman Catholic leadership and let the Bible be the only standard. And so in the Swiss context, there was really a sense in which the magistrate, the various syndics or leaders of the various Swiss cantons would set up a hearing, and they as a panel of judges would listen to the debate. Should the Reformation come or not? And Zwingli debated with the Roman Catholic leadership in Zurich, and he won the debate. He had set the ground rules that it should be debated only on the scriptures. And the syndics determined they would follow that as the ground rules. And so with the ground rule of the Bible alone, he effectively countered all of the historical traditional arguments that would prove the various Roman Catholic distinctives. And so early on, in the early 1520s, Zwingli has effectively established the necessity of the Reformation coming to Zurich and the demonstration that the Mass was not, in fact, biblical. Now, that was quite a major accomplishment. He brought in a biblical form of Reformation. He brought it in on the basis of biblical authority, and he had gotten the vote of the magistrate that the Mass was unbiblical. So what do you do next? Well, his young followers said, you shut down the Mass. You go into the churches and say, you don't do this anymore. It's unbiblical. What did Zwingli do? Zwingli said, our people are not ready for our victory. We have to re-educate them for the fact, yes, we think it's unbiblical. Yes, we've won the battle. But if we walk in tomorrow and suddenly shut down the Mass, we're going to have a protest on our hands because no one will understand why we've done it, and they'll think it's a blasphemy against what they worship. And so Zwingli exercised, if you will, some prudence. Now, prudence is not always wise, and sometimes it is, but he was being careful. Well, his young understudies, who had become deeply committed to the Reformation, were offended by Zwingli's willingness to compromise at that point. He had been the leader. He'd fought for these truths. He had actually established the Reformation, and he stopped it, seemingly, because he didn't want to offend anyone and he wanted time. Well, that created a new movement that will break from Zwingli, his own converts to the Reformation movement, and they will call themselves the Swiss Brethren. Okay? Now, the Swiss Brethren are an interesting movement because they have already demonstrated that they want Reformation and they're willing to go forward as fast as they possibly can. Okay, so these are the younger more radical as youth sometimes can be, not always, but many times might be. Remember, we said the young humanists tended to go with the Reformation, the older humanists didn't. Well, the younger generation looking to Zwingli said, you've been a great hero, but you've compromised, you've let us down. And so they began to continue their studies, and they discovered, to their best reading of Scripture, that the issue of infant baptism was not found in the New Testament. And they said, we've been baptizing infants for an awful long time, and we've been having the Mass for an awful long time, and it's time that we now set aside this other papal error in the church called infant baptism. Okay, now this is quite a remarkable step. So what occurs? Well, there is a major debate. I think there are now what we would call the third and fourth Zurich disputations. The first and second Zurich disputations are when the Reformation was brought in and the Mass was demonstrated to be false. The third and fourth Zurich disputations, based again on the Bible alone, and this was the issue, what about the issue of baptism? Well, Zwingli won the debates with the Anabaptist theologians. Now, you need to realize that the Anabaptist theologians are not Anabaptists yet. They're the Swiss Brethren. They are his followers. But this is where the Anabaptist movement will be born. The word Anna, you know that if you've done some Johannine studies, where it says you must be born again. It can mean born from above or a repetition of a birth, born again. Well, here it means a second baptism. They were arguing that there must be a true baptism, and they did not call themselves the Anabaptists because they came to the conclusion that infant baptism was unbiblical. They had not been baptized. At any rate, they're not the Anabaptists yet. That's where they're heading. And in their discussions at this early stage, they come to Zwingli and say, Zwingli, you know, you've wimped out on the issue of the Mass, and you're not ready to go forward to clean house on infant baptism. What do you think? Can you find it in the Bible? And it's very interesting. There was a period for about 2 months in the year, I think, 1524, where Zwingli suspended judgment on whether infant baptism was biblical or not. Now, let that sink in for a moment. Imagine how important Zwingli's role is in history. What if he had sided on a different direction than he did? Well, the Reformed tradition would look very different today in its sacramental theology. During that time, he actually wrote to his friend Ecolampadius, another great humanist name. It means a house in the light, or a light in the house. It's a scholar. He has a lamp burning all night reading his books. So he was an Old Testament scholar, one of the great first reformational students to lecture on Isaiah, a great scholar in this Reformed era. And he asked him, what do you think? And Ecolampadius wrote back and said, up till now, I'm still committed to what Augustine said, that baptism takes away original sin. He said his arguments satisfy me, that children are born with a sin nature, they need to have sin removed, that's why we need infant baptism. So you see, at that point, that is very much a historic Roman Catholic understanding of baptism by a key Reformational leader. He had heard that Karlstadt and others who were in the Reformational movement were questioning whether infant baptism was biblical. And so he was wondering, what do I do? How do I deal with this? In the midst of this discussion, when the debate came to the fore, Zwingli had come to the conclusion that infant baptism was biblical. Now, how did he get there? He did not argue on the basis of tradition. His whole Reformation was, we got to go to the Bible. This was what he had established as the Reformation in Zurich, the biblical authority. So as he began to wrestle with the text, just as the debates had been going on with his own friends, who were the Swiss Brethren, his students, he was lecturing through the book of Genesis. And as he was lecturing through the book of Genesis, it struck him very deeply that Genesis 17 seemingly was a very important text to talk about God's dealing with the children of believers. Now, you remember the story of Genesis 17. It's when Abram, exalted father, becomes Abraham, the father of nations. And there is a sign that is given to his children that are given on the eighth day of life, and it reflects a sign that he only got after his faith. It was a sign called circumcision. And so what Zwingli does is that he looks at that text, and in his commentary on Genesis, he actually creates a chart. Okay, and he has what's called Abraham's chart and the Christian's chart. In Abraham's chart, he begins to note the parallel. There's Abraham's God is our God. The promise made to Abraham's children is the same promise made to our children. There's a sign that's given to his children There's a sign that's given to our children. They are to be taught the ways of the Lord. Abraham's children are to be trained in the things of God. And so are ours as well. And at that point in the history of the church, you find the first theological description of a covenantal infant baptism, but at that point he does not argue from covenant unity explicitly. It's implicit. He's comparing New Testament, Old Testament on the basis of Abraham. And as he does that, he will then say, when he argues with his Anabaptist friends, those who are arguing to get rid of this baptism of infants, that, well, I find this parallel. And further, he had also noted the text in 1 Corinthians 7:14 that says that the child of one believing parent is sanctified, and the marriage is sanctified by the believer. Now, he doesn't go into what all that means, but his implication is that there is a familial sanctifying through the faith of one parent. And he argues that that then brings this child into a covenant relationship of some kind, and that that is why baptism is then given. In fact, if you have ever heard anyone argue with you about infant baptism, and I'm sure we do not have unanimity in this group. There's some who would believe in it, some who would not. But in the debate, you've often heard this argument. If when the covenant was its most narrow, God included infants, now that the covenant has gone to the whole world, Jew and Gentile alike, why now would the infant suddenly be excluded? Ever heard that argument? In the Old Testament age, the covenant was very narrow. Only Israel. And yet the infants were included. Now the whole nations enjoy it. Why are the infants suddenly excluded? Well, that argument that is often used was developed by Zwingli. That is his gift to the debate. And the pedo-Baptist and the anti-pedo-Baptist deal with that argument. That was Zwingli who wrote that into the text, and we have been dealing with it ever since. By the way, it's also at the core of the logic that those who believe in pedo-communion will offer. And at this time, there was no desire to bring infants to the Lord's table. But there are those who would argue, if you use that argument, well, then you ought to also include the children in the Lord's Supper, because now it's more gracious than ever. You know, the infants should be included even more if the grace is greater. Why would you keep them from the advancing grace? So that kind of argument is tried to be turned back upon the whole discussion. Well, regardless of where you stand on that, what I want you to see is that Zwingli is wrestling with the issue, how do I explain this sacrament in a biblical way? And he will establish then a very powerful argument based upon the parallelism of Genesis 17 and the New Testament believer. And eventually he will describe that as covenant unity. So covenant theology is born out of the clash between Zwingli and his students over the biblical character of baptizing infants of believers. That creates an idea of how do we put the covenant together. Now, don't get me wrong. Augustine had argued for the Old Testament having a very Christian expression. But explicitly focusing on the covenant as the motif or theological perspective of a system of theology in the Reformation, that is Zwingli who takes the first major step. And therefore, if you come to Westminster, as you have, and you're being exposed to covenant theology, this school is clearly a very big footnote in the tradition that goes back to Zwingli. We are part of that stream. It's interesting, there's a fascinating dialogue that's been preserved historically between a man named Dr. Balthasar Hubmaier, who was a Roman Catholic doctor in the church who was converted to the Reformation. And he too will become an Anabaptist, and he will be a debater with Zwingli over these issues. And in these discussions, they will talk about what you can't find in the New Testament, you force yourself to go back to the Old. And so you can see the debate. The Old Testament is not where we get our theology. It's the New. And so do we keep the Old Testament as a theological canon for the church, or is that excluded as something that's distinct? And so you can see the hints of the great lines of theological development that will be between Baptist and Reformed. And even in a sense, the idea of diminishing Old Testament authority and what might become a hint of even a dispensational sort of thought. At any rate, these backdrops then create the birth of covenant theology, which I'm going to talk about more probably in our second hour, or maybe just a hint at the end of this first one. As Zwingli continues his Reformation, and he wins the third and fourth Zurich disputations, the Anabaptists are now called on the line to submit to the magistrate. Remember, church and state are coming together because this is the magisterial Reformation. As the magistrate says, it is now required that you baptize your children because it is biblical, and this is an expression of our government. It puts these Swiss Brethren thinkers in a crisis mode. Will they submit to the church state order, or will they stand distinct? And in the wrestling over these things, already smarting because they saw Zwingli as a compromiser, he had been too slow to get rid of the Mass. They tried to clean house as they saw it in regard to infant baptism, and he was opposed to it. They decided to take things into their own hands. And so on Christmas Day in the year 1525, the Anabaptist movement was officially born. There were three great men, Felix Mantz, George Blaurock, and I'll think of the other one a little bit. I have them in my notes. I'll look them up in a minute. I'll give you their exact names. But these two men, plus a third man, whose name is blanking on me for the moment, started the movement. One of them said, someone has to be properly baptized as a believer before we can give it to someone else. And so he took the milk bucket that he had, went to the well in the center of the city, filled it with water, and he baptized himself in the name of the triune God by pouring. And then on the basis of that, he baptized the others and said, now we've done it biblically. We've done it as believers. We've done it with water. We've done it in the name of the triune God. And someone had to get it right. He was the reformer, and was called the sea Baptist, meaning the self-baptized one. He's the one that started the order because they had lost that view of true believers' baptism. Now, that created a crisis. This was a rebellion. They were not baptizing their children. They were insisting on baptizing believers. So what happened? Well, the magistrate got involved because that's what he must do. He must enforce the laws. And so they began to say to baptize again, to be an Anabaptist, is to put yourself in jeopardy of the coercive power of the state. What did that mean? It meant possibly you could be fined, arrested, exiled. And if you continued to persist after these punishments, ultimately you would be killed. Now, this is very interesting because this is going back to the earlier order of the law during the Byzantine era of the Justinian Code. I don't know if you all remember your ancient church history, but let's go back in our mind's eye for a moment. 325 is the date when the Council of Nicaea establishes, if you will, a doctrinal statement on the Trinity that will be the theological view of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is now a Christian empire. And from that point on until the fall of the Roman Empire to the various invasions that will occur in the early medieval period, we have an era in the West that will continue in the East for another 1,000 years called the Byzantine era. This is the time of Christian Rome. Justinian was the emperor, and the Justinian Code said, if you are rebaptized, you will face capital punishment. So you can see the idea of how do you deal with someone who's going to insist on a second baptism and persist in it is that, well, the ancient church, when the government worked in this arena, said it was a capital offense. Now, we have to scratch our heads and say, why was this so important? Well, let's remember now that we are in an arena that is called Switzerland. Switzerland is a place where there were covenanters that went back into the medieval period. People who saw themselves banded together as a state of citizens fighting for their independence and their rights. In fact, there's a whole study that's been done that I think I alluded to in our very first lecture of the concept of the sacral society, a society that saw itself wholly in covenant with each other to protect God's favor upon the state. And you might put in your mind's eye the story of Achan in the book of Joshua. You remember when he saw the illicit booty and kept some of it for himself? What did he do? He brought judgment on the entire nation. They lost at Ai. They beat Jericho. And then they went to this little backwater town in Ai they couldn't win. And they discovered one person had compromised the holy integrity of this whole confederated nation called Israel. That idea began to permeate into Switzerland because in this context they had this notion of citizenship, of individual duties. And it reflected further something of this idea of the covenanting, of coming together. The imperial city, we talked about that, how they were distinct citizenships in the midst of other countries. They were city-states. And in that context, they saw every person's action reflecting on the whole. so that you did not act as an individual. You tried to bring about a whole unit of action. And so what was a denial of infant baptism doing? It was creating a breach in a unified state. It was creating a state within a state, a church within a church. And that meant that you could be a Swissman, but you were not faithful to Switzerland in this canton because you had not followed the church that was the legal church. That was divisive. It was destabilizing. And further, it brought the fear that perhaps you might bring the very judgment of God upon this community because you were standing as a rebel against God's lordship over this community. That idea is fascinating. There are those who pointed out the very people who in Switzerland who had for years, sometimes centuries, built their great cathedrals with all of their beautiful icons. Some of them were just finished building them, who at the end of their generation were tearing them down with their own hands, saying, "We've sinned against God," saying, "We can't bring this judgment of idolatry on our community." Once they understood what had to happen, they tried to do their work of cleaning spiritually. There was a sacral society mentality that comes from the medieval period, especially strong in the imperial cities and the Swiss cantons. Very consistent with the idea of covenanting, of covenant theology. You can see the parallels, I think, if you reflect on it. Now, there have been studies that have been done in that whole arena, but I'm introducing you now to the concept rather than the authors. Now, as you look at that then, you can begin to understand why there was such a radical response to the radical Reformation. They were splitting the nation. They were splitting the church. They were bringing the liability of divine judgment by violating the sacrament. Zwingli had labored long and hard to work with the magistrates so that the whole community would go together. He even delayed the change in the Mass when he'd won it so the whole community could go together. And now there were those who were standing as individuals pursuing their own ends in spite of the state, in spite of the magistrate, and they looked like subversives, radicals. And since they would not repent, the law that was ancient, the Code of Justinian, said, put them to death. And so with profound irony, Zwingli will write a book called Against the Kata Baptists. Now, do you remember what your Greek says when you see the prefix kata? It can mean according to, or it can mean under. An intensification of putting under. They're the Anabaptists that rebaptize. Well, he calls them the Kata Baptists, the drowners. He said, you are drowning the souls of men by teaching them subversive actions, teaching them to break from the church and its unity. And what was the punishment? Well, it's to be kata baptizoed, that you would be immersed, not to come up. They drowned the Anabaptists. That was the punishment. This was for the incorrigible Anabaptist, the one that would not give up. Now, that's part of your Reformed heritage. Okay, sometimes I step back and say, Lord, thank you for America, where we've understood a little bit more about freedom of conscience. But before we are too harsh on Zwingli, you have to put them back in their milieu. There was a reason for why they did what they did and how they did what they did. It doesn't make it easy from a modern perspective of religious liberty and the rights of conscience. But you do need to understand they were appealing to ancient Christian practice of jurisprudence under Justinian. They understood the notion of working together as a body, as a covenanted people. But nevertheless, there were Reformed-type people, who we would call today perhaps Reformed Baptists, that were drowned by Zwingli, a Reformed covenanting theologian. Yes. Yeah. Ultimately, Zwingli never claimed for the state any power to execute anyone, to bring about coercive action. They followed either the notion, well, let's say the Swiss reformers followed the model of what we call Erastianism, named for a theologian named Erastus, who said that the state is to be over the church, that there is to be a real sense before this church can exercise its discipline, its actions, it must always get state approval. In a certain sense, if you think about the Westminster Assembly, okay, which is part of this tradition, they call their document Humble Advice of the Divines Assembled at Westminster. They were looking to the state to say, this is what we think the theology of the church ought to be. It's not like, we're the pastors, we're the theologians, listen to what you... No, we got to come. Now, you're going to find there's going to be more of a balancing, I think, under Calvin, where he's wanting to assert more a distinctive life to the church, but very much a cooperative life. And so you get more of a what I would call a sphere sovereignty in Calvin. But Erastianism is very much part of the German-Swiss Reformation, where they looked to the state to govern, which is very consistent with the Constantinian model, where it was the emperor who called for the council at Nicaea. They were picking up that classical ancient church. There's no question that Augustine's notion of the city of God is the backdrop of all of the medieval tradition into the Reformation. Augustine had argued that the church is the kingdom of God. And I think the Reformers held to that. I think biblical theologians in the Reformed tradition are willing to say, well, the kingdom of God is probably broader than the church. It's profoundly expressed in the church, but it is not the church as an organization, although it's at work there. And of course, you'll debate that. But classic Reformational theology would have been very Augustinian, said, the church is the kingdom of Christ. They are coextensive. And that means that, you know, this is Christ's rule here. And so while they would not have wanted to give the sword of into Luther or Calvin's hand, they would have, on the other hand, said, pay attention to the church. It has a lot of authority. And so when it does give its verdict, you don't lightly turn your back on the judgment of the church. It says, this man has violated the holy things of God. You better take him up on blasphemy laws. We think he's a culprit. We found him guilty. Well, he still had to be tried by the state. But the recommendation of the church in that era is the kingdom of Christ would not have been lightly dismissed. And so the death sentence was not implemented by the church, but it was determined in a real sense by the church. It had been very, very difficult in that era where church and kingdom are coextensive. So yes, the Augustinian notion of the city of God and the church being identical is at least part of the backdrop that was a continuation from the medieval period. Okay, other comments on that? Okay, well, what do we do with this? Well, remember now, as Zwingli goes forward, he writes the book against the Catabaptists, I think about 1527. So you can see in the seven-year period from the early 1520s to there, the Anabaptist movement went from being his fellow allies to his disgruntled younger followers, to those who broke, who were advocating a fuller Reformation, to those who were condemned, and now those who would not conform and became a counterculture that faced, obviously, attention. Now, as you look at this then, and we'll talk more about the Anabaptist movement, I want you to realize there are several spheres from which the Anabaptists will come. Luther will look at Zwingli and say, this problem of the Anabaptists is all Zwingli's fault. He's the one that created this breach. I think Luther kind of overlooked the peasants' revolt that had a part of the beginning of this counterculture. In fact, most Anabaptist research today, or research on the Radical Reformation, will say there are multiple origins for the Anabaptist movement. We cannot look only to Zwingli, but we will find these sorts of breaking with the magisterial and the Roman Catholic Reformational or classic movements in many places. And they will all be part of the milieu of the age, asking, what does God want from us? How should we have the church? And at this point, you can see that the Swiss brethren did not have the magistrate behind them. The magistrate had said, your view is unacceptable. That created then a tension that would create a more radical movement that says, we're going to teach what we believe no matter what anybody thinks, no matter what the cost. And that kind of tension then will spread from there and team up with the same sort of experience in other places in this period of time. All right. Now, we have already noted in the other area of the sacramental theology of Zwingli that he will become a theologian that affirms a different view of the Lord's Supper than Luther. He will break with the Mass, but as he breaks with the Mass, he will insist that Luther's model is unacceptable. Let me go back and not retell the whole story of the Colloquy of Marburg. We've already told it once, but let me highlight some of the distinctive contributions of Zwingli in that great debate where Luther would not shake the hand. Do you remember we told that story? Ecolampadius was there, and also Zwingli, and there was this sense, no, we will not shake the hand. Basically, to highlight some of the basic arguments that Zwingli brought, the flesh profits nothing, John 6, Jesus' words are spirit. And so he emphasized in this context not only the memorial sense, but there was a spiritual eating. And so the spiritual presence theology has a hint in Zwingli, although it's never developed as strongly or clearly as we will find it in Calvin. Okay, there is a continuity with the spiritual eating between both the Swiss and French Reformations, and there will actually be a merging. We'll talk about that later under Calvin and Bullinger. But he will argue there is no physical eating, it is only spiritual, and that the physical eating would be valueless under any circumstance, because Jesus says, my words are spirit and they are life. Therefore, the supper was believed by only the believer. The Christ is now the glorified Christ bodily at the right hand of God the Father, and he never loses his nature of being a human, even though he's glorified, which means he is localized, even though glorified. He is ascended into heaven. He said, when we confess in the Apostles' Creed, he rose from the dead and ascended into heaven. He said, if the right hand of God is everywhere, the ascension of Christ becomes meaningless, because Christ ascended to everywhere. Where is he? He's at the right hand of the Father. There is a sense that it's localized. And if you say he's every place presence, then you've changed the character of a human body. Well, do you remember the argument that certain divine attributes are given to the humanity of Christ? Well, Zwingli would argue, well, then are there certain human elements that are given to the divine nature of God? If there is going to be a communicatio idiomatorum, then it must move both directions. And if it does, it's not that we are Nestorians, as you claim, Luther, that you're separating the two natures of Christ. It's rather you've become a Eutychian, where you're confusing the two natures of Christ, where you're blending them and keeping them distinct. Do you remember how the Eutychians, a version of the Monophysites, argued? They said the human nature is like a drop of wine placed into the ocean, very insignificant compared to the expansiveness of God, but it does permeate it and becomes one with it. And so the two natures become monophusis, one nature. And that was what Eutyches taught. And so Zwingli says, Luther, you are becoming a Christological heretic. You are blending together the divine and the human into one. Okay, and then finally, we pointed out, not only are you confusing the two natures, but you're overlooking the fact when you argue against reason, you're using reason, and by using a careful analysis of the text, we must recognize that there is, in fact, a very clear sense of a figure of speech in the elements themselves. It's not the Holy Grail that you must have when Jesus says, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, but it's what it contains. That is a metonymy of the container for the contained. Further, he says, when you make the right hand of God everywhere, are you not turning the right hand of God now into a figure of speech when you've argued so much about literalism? You say the right hand of God is God's presence everywhere. Well, now that's not literal anymore. It's not spatial, which is the concept, but it becomes symbolic. But at any rate, as we noted, that will be the cleavage that will take place between Luther and Zwingli in a final way over the Lord's Supper. We're going to have to take a break in just a couple minutes, but I want you to understand that there are other key issues that are at the bottom of the break between Zwingli and Luther. And I'll highlight them now, and we'll talk about them when we come back after lunch. What are the other issues? One of which is election. How does election work? Secondly, what about salvation outside of knowledge of Christ? Can people be saved who've never heard of Christ? Thirdly, what about original sin? What is original sin? Okay. Fourthly, there's the issue of the third use of the law. And then fifthly, we're going to talk about it more fully, the idea of the importance of the covenant in theology. So while it's true at the Marburg Colloquy in 1529, Luther and Zwingli had a rupture over the Lord's Supper, what we must understand is that there are a whole host of other theological issues lurking under the surface that made them unable to communicate and that ultimately created the breach, and that as those ideas are worked out, they only made the rupture between Zurich and Wittenberg that much more visible and that much more permanent. Okay? So with that, let's stop and see if we have any quick questions before we take our break. Yes? Well, at this point, the connection with the Luther and the Anabaptist are simply that Luther blamed Zwingli for creating the Anabaptist movement because his Reformation was so poorly done, in his opinion, that it created all this internal division, and then they ended up having a movement that wanted believers' baptism. He said, look at Zwingli. He has the Lord's Supper fouled up. He started the Anabaptist movement, and he's a mess, and he's got some other problems. So that's the connection with Luther. Now, I moved on from Luther, I mean the Anabaptists, to talk about other distinctives in Zwingli so that we can appreciate them vis-a-vis Luther, not just the Anabaptists now. Okay? Any other questions? All right. As we conclude then before our lunch break, let me just highlight the fact that we will come back to talk more fully about the Anabaptist movement later. But as an American Presbyterian, I have to confess that I'm very grateful for the Anabaptists' insistence on the liberty of conscience. I'm grateful that we do not have a church state. I think it was a great insight that took the Anabaptists. As much as I disagree with much of their theology, their insight, I think, was very biblical and ultimately brought about the spiritual character of the church. The church has always struggled when it's carried the coercive power of government with it. Now, one of the dangers we have in America is the church retreating from its moral role in the state, in its culture. And I think it may be on the other side. We become, as Reformed people, too Anabaptist. And I'm saying that as an activist, remember. I'm an activist. That I think we ought to be speaking more boldly on moral issues. Not politicizing the church, but not being afraid to be salt and light. So that's another issue for the modern age, which I'll just hint at my views as we go along on that.